It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we've cut back so much on daily activity in the United States and elsewhere that the equipment that detects earthquakes can actually show the difference. A seismologist tells us how the Earth itself is a little quieter these days. First, this week marked the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, and it's a time when we're all trying our best to make fewer trips to the grocery store. On this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll get more resourceful with our cooking and make better use of our cooking resources by using a lot of stuff we might usually throw away. Lindsay Jean Hart is former editor of Food 52. She wrote the cookbook Cooking with Scraps. Turn your peels, cores, rinds, and stems into delicious meals. Lindsay, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
What inspired you to try to figure out some creative uses for some of the things a lot of us, myself included, might usually treat as garbage?
Well, there were a lot of different things that really led me to this path. I think I've always been really focused on the environment and focused on sustainability, and that's just manifested itself in different ways over the years. But when I was working at Food 52, we were having an editorial meeting, and Gabrielle Hamilton's cookbook Prune had just come out, and that has a chapter in it on garbage. And it was one of those moments where I felt like, oh, this is something I really have to be involved in. And we wanted to turn that idea into a column. And so I would look for recipes on Food 52 that the community had submitted that were focused on making smart uses of all of these underutilized produce parts and other odds and ends. And I would feature them. And I learned a lot myself during that time. And then I wanted to share that with a broader audience. So that's where this cookbook was really born.
We'll get into some specific advice and specific foods, but in general, can you talk about building a mindset of using more of the groceries in our fridge and pantry?
Well, like you said, that's really what it's all about. It's just shifting the way that we think about these things. I think a lot of us have been in a position of privilege where we can read a recipe and it will tell us to cut off and discard a kale stem. And maybe we don't have to think about that. And we are able to just discard that and put it in the compost bin. So it really takes us stopping and thinking and reevaluating, is this edible? What could I be doing with it? Because not only are most of these parts edible, they really are delicious too. And we should start to think about them as ingredients.
Let's start to look at particular things. I got to say, reading through the book, I kept having these wow, no, really? Kind of moments. One of them is apple scraps, our cores, our peels, things like that. You've got some great ways to use those instead of throwing them away or composting them, which is what I usually do. Can you give us a couple pieces of advice for those apple bits that get wasted?
Yeah, well, you don't want to eat the seeds. Those are the only part that right. You want to avoid. But the cores and the peels themselves still have a lot of that flavor. So you can dry the apple peels and turn them into like little apple chips. You can also cook down the cores in a sugar syrup. And then you can use that to flavor beverages like a hot tea, or you can keep boiling it down and turn it into like an apple flavored syrup that you could use on pancakes.
We're talking about making the most of our food and using the scraps that we often waste. Lindsay Jean Hart is with us. She's author of the cookbook Cooking with Scraps, Turn Your Peels, Cores, Rinds, and Stems into Delicious Meals. We've got a few recipes that you shared with us, Lindsay Jean, at WPR.org Food Friday. I want to start getting into those now. Kale stem, and kale stems, often I tear the leaves off and get rid of the stem. Kale stem hummus. Can you talk about how we make that?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite recipes that's in here. And I generally don't advocate for hiding scraps. I think that they are ingredients in their own right and are worth celebrating. But this is one where kale stems could be chopped up finely and sauteed if you're just going to be sauteing the leaves in something else. But for a recipe where you really don't want to use those stems, you can save them and cook them until they're soft. And then you can blend them right into a hummus. And this hummus is very smooth and creamy, and you would never guess that you have these kale stems blended into it, and it just adds a little bit of extra fiber into it.
I love that. And you know, kale is big among the health conscious these days. Did you, when kale first started getting big, did your kind of no waste mind start to think, oh, you know, we're throwing away this tough bit. There's got to be something we could do with that.
Yeah, I did. And absolutely. Kale is one of my favorite vegetables. I'm actually wearing my kale sweatshirt right now while I talk to you. So I'm a huge advocate for kale and not throwing any of it away.
Now, here's a bit of advice that we're going to love here in Wisconsin. Cheese rinds. You know, we might cut off the rind of cheese, and I never know. Can you eat those? Can you not? You talk about using that as a flavoring ingredient. How can we do that?
Right. So you don't want to use any that have the wax or any other right. non-edible wrappings on them. But for any other kind of cheese, I like to just store them in the freezer because they can add great flavor into soups or like a pot full of beans. And just add in one or two rinds, or you could even collect a bunch of them and make a broth just completely out of those cheese rinds.
You mentioned storage there, and I wanted to ask, I do a little bit of this. I save bread ends and rolls and things like that and make croutons or bread pudding and things like that. And I get made fun of for having, you know, bags and bins of old bread in the freezer. Walk us through your fridge and freezer. What does it look like? How do you have all this stuff stored?
Well, storage is a huge piece of not wasting the food that we have. You know, 40% of food in the United States goes uneaten. And although that happens at every level in the chain, the biggest portion of that is happening in our own homes. So it's upsetting, but I think it's also encouraging because we have the power to change that number. So it's really important when you get stuff home from the farmer's market or the grocery store to plan how you're going to use it during the week and figure out your meals and then cycle through your fridge and your freezer every so often, so you make sure you know what's in there and what's hiding at the back of your crisper drawers so you can get to it before it goes bad. And one quick tip for things that have roots and leaves like beets or carrots, you want to make sure that you separate those and store the two parts separately as soon as you get home from the store so they'll both last longer.
I know you're a big fan of those greens on things like beets. And oh, and here's one. You talk about carrot greens, and I'm probably not the only person who thought I heard somewhere out there that you're not supposed to eat the carrot greens. They're bad for you. I am wrong in that thinking, correct?
Yes, you are. I don't know how this happened, that carrot tops got this bad rap that they're poisonous. I think it just might be because they're bitter. They aren't poisonous. They're delicious. One of my favorite recipes in the cookbook is for a carrot top pesto. But they can add nice flavor to things on their own. You can add sprigs of it into salads, and they're beautiful too.
It's Food Friday. We're talking with Lindsay Jean Hard. She's former editor of Food 52, and she's the author of the cookbook, Cooking with Scraps. Turn your peels, cores, rinds, and stems into delicious meals. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have creative ways you use up food scraps, you know, stems or peels or butt ends of the bread or whatever? What have you done in your kitchen to reduce the amount of food waste? Have you done some of the things that our guest is talking about? Or do you have a question for her about how to lower the amount of waste in your kitchen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can find a few recipes to use your scraps that she provided for us. They're at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Lindsay Jean Hard. She's a former editor of Food 52 and the author of the cookbook Cooking with Scraps. Turn your peels, cores, rinds, and stems into delicious meals. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found some creative ways to use food scraps in your kitchen? What do you try to do to reduce waste when you're cooking? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller now. Ron is with us in Madison. Ron, hi.
Hi. I can't find the recipe on the computer. It must have been in the older computer that crashed. after the big head carp and silver carp started thriving in the Mississippi River basin, and they were afraid they were going to get into the Great Lakes, I created a recipe for, based on experience when I was much younger, about using those as food. We got to get rid of the invasive species like that. And recently, feral hogs have been tearing up Texas, and I'm sure many other states. I keep saying wild mustard, but there is a invasive plant that is edible, and it's spreading all over Wisconsin.
I gotcha, Ron. So eating those invasive species, I don't know if that's something you, Lindsay Jean, have worked with yourself, but it definitely fits the philosophy of, you know, taking those things, if they are edible, of course, the things that we might not think of as food, and revisiting them.
Yes, it definitely does. I haven't personally done a lot with that, but I like the mindset.
Right. Let's take a look at another one of your recipes. Speaking of things we don't think of cooking with very often, I think, coffee grounds, and I have used them to flavor pancakes in the distant past. You've got a recipe that you've shared with us for coffee grounds, cashew butter. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, so coffee grounds still have a lot of great coffee flavor in them. So in this recipe, I'm using them along with cashews to create a coffee-flavored cashew butter. If cashews aren't your thing, you could swap in any other nut. But it just adds not only coffee flavor, but a little bit of texture too, depending on how coarsely ground your coffee is. You can also use coffee grounds to infuse flavor into things like milk or cream, and then you could make whipped cream that's coffee flavored.
Ooh, I like the sound of that. Let's go back to our callers now with Donald in Iron River. Donald, hi.
Hi. I save all my carrot ends and celery ends and onion skins, and then I do make a stock of broth with it.
Ooh, that's a classic. Definitely, Donald, thanks for calling in. Lindsay Jean, do you have ideas on using our scraps in soup or, as Donald does, in making a soup stock?
Yeah, I definitely have guidelines for doing stocks. I think it's really helpful to just keep a bag in your freezer so then you can just add to it as you go and keep little bits. And then once you have a full bag, then you can go ahead and make stock.
Thanks a lot for that call. The one thing I used to do, broccoli stems, somebody told me, and I realized using them, they kind of add a weird flavor to my stock. But you, I think in the cookbook, you had some good uses for those broccoli stems that I usually just compost. What can we do with those?
I love broccoli stems. I really like the texture. You can use them however you use broccoli, just chopping them up and sauteing them. I also like treating them sort of like a bone almost. And so you're cooking them, so you're just getting what would be the marrow or the very softest part out of the center of the broccoli.
Okay, so you might just peel them and then use that in our recipes.
Yeah, if it's not quite as fresh, you want to peel off that tougher outer layer, okay. But you certainly don't have to.
All right, thanks again for that call. I want to check out one recipe that you shared with us. You know, banana peels, of course, it's a great wrapper, but I usually think of that as just waste. You've got a banana peel cake with brown sugar frosting. Now, what happens to the banana peel here?
I think this is probably the most surprising recipe for folks in the book to learn that banana peels are edible. You really just need to soften them up a little bit, and then they can puree. And think of it almost like adding applesauce into like a quick bread. It's just that fruit puree in this case, a cake. And since this cookbook was published, I realized there's even an easier way of doing this. You can freeze a whole banana and then take that whole frozen banana and just remove the ends and puree the whole flesh and peel. And you can use that in this cake recipe, or you can use that if you make smoothies in the morning.
Let's bring back our callers now. Tammy is with us in Mason. Tammy, hi.
Hi. I got two secrets to give everybody. Okay, my family's from Dublin, Ireland. Now, when you make your corned beef or any kind of big brisket or anything like that, make a full pot of coffee and put it in the slow cooker, and it'd be the moistest thing you've ever had in your life. And now to make your hamburger, 2 pounds of hamburger, but you put in oatmeal and some Wheaties or something like that, or cornflakes, and you add that into it, and you end up with 4 pounds of it, and you put it in a bun pan. instead of a bread pan.
Why does that help it cook more evenly? What happens there?
It cooks evenly. You got to have it at 350, and you end up with a bigger meatloaf.
Tammy, thanks a lot for those ideas straight from Dublin. Well, that's so, Lindsay Jean, that's a case where maybe instead of that fresh pot of coffee, that's a used for, you know, the coffee that's left in the pot anyway. And maybe it's your stale cereal and bread. Those could be a couple good uses for the scraps.
Absolutely. I love that.
Thanks so much for that call at 800-642-1234. Lindsay Jean, I understand you've been working with kids and cooking lately. Do they have fun cooking with those weird bits?
Yeah, they do. I think it's really fun to see their faces when, you know, we go down the list and I give them a quiz ahead of time of, can you eat this or not? And it's really fun to see them get excited about what they can and can't eat and be able to make things with them, because I think kids and adults really are more excited about trying new things when they get to eat them afterwards.
Well, in our last few moments, Lindsay Jean, can you share one more fun tip with us, maybe a good springtime one to give us some food for thought?
Oh, I would say that frittatas are a good one to be using any of your scraps, especially when you're getting all like scallions and lots of other herbs maybe, so you're not letting them go bad and wilty in your fridge, and chopping them up. And you can add all sorts of odds and ends into a frittata, and it comes out looking like a really nice dinner that you put a lot of effort into.
Lindsay Jean, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for having me.
Lindsay Jean Hart is a former editor of Food 52. She wrote the cookbook Cooking with Scraps: Turn Your Peels, Cores, Rinds, and Stems into delicious Meals. She joined us for our Food Friday conversation. And if you go to WPR.org/Food Friday, you can find a few of the recipes she shared. The coffee grounds, the coffee grounds cashew butter, right? And the banana peel cake with brown sugar frosting, again, over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Protesters are gathering today outside the Wisconsin Capitol to call on the governor to reopen Wisconsin. The gathering flies in the face of public health warnings to avoid large crowds to stop the spread of COVID-19. It's also a departure from the bipartisan approach to the new coronavirus that Wisconsin politicians had promoted as recently as last week. Sean Johnson reports on how we got here.
It's easy to lose track of time in the age of COVID-19, but a lot has happened in just the last month. Of course, there was that huge fight between Republicans and Democrats over whether to have Wisconsin's April election. But that aside, things seemed different. About a month ago, Governor Tony Evers was briefing members of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce on the state's response to COVID-19. And WMC President Kurt Bauer was praising Evers.
We appreciate your tireless leadership and appreciate the time.
Around that same time, Evers' adversary in the legislature, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, was rejecting suggestions that lawmakers should look to roll back the governor's emergency powers.
I think we're going to look back and have questions about how all this went, but this is not the appropriate time to question it.
And just last week, the Wisconsin legislature held its first ever virtual session. Republican Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said it felt like the world had changed.
Wisconsinites have endured great sacrifice, and the measures that we have taken and that the governor has taken so far are working.
Senators voted 32-0 for a coronavirus relief bill. It passed the assembly 97-2. But already, change was happening in the world of Republican politics. Conservative radio host Mark Belling of WISN was no fan of the virtual session.
If you were too lazy to come in, or you're too afraid of the coronavirus to come in, whichever one it was, furlough yourself.
And when he had Senator Fitzgerald on his show on the day of the Senate's vote, Belling let him have it. He said lawmakers should have forced Evers to roll back at least some of his stay-at-home restrictions.
This level of frustration that I'm trying to communicate to you is real, and people don't know who to turn to, because on the one hand, they know Evers isn't going to listen to him, but it is extremely apparent to me that conservative think tanks and Republican legislators are not listening.
Eventually, Fitzgerald shot back and laid some of the blame elsewhere.
The President of the United States is on TV for 2 hours every day, continuing with the mantra that's coming out of the East Coast, which is, oh my God, the world is coming to an end.
Trump's message was dire a few weeks ago.
I want every American to be prepared for the hard days that lie ahead. We're going to go through a very tough 2 weeks.
But by last week, he was talking about lifting restrictions.
We're opening up our country, and we have to do that.
Last Friday, Trump seemed to egg on stay-at-home opponents by tweeting that Virginia, Michigan, and Minnesota should be liberated. But when Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, a Trump-endorsed Republican, moved to reopen his state, Trump said this week that it was too soon.
Would I do that? No. I'd keep him a little longer. I want to protect people's lives.
In Wisconsin, Governor Tony Evers pointed to White House guidelines when he announced another month-long stay-at-home order and a plan to very gradually reopen the state. Wisconsin Republicans say the goal of 12,000 daily COVID-19 tests called for in Evers' plan is too aggressive and the stay-at-home order too broad. They've asked the state Supreme Court to overturn it. But opponents of stay-at-home are not waiting. Stephen Moore, a founder of the Club for Growth and a Trump economic advisor, said in a YouTube chat last week that it was an important time for civil disobedience and said he was helping to organize the Wisconsin protest.
We have one big donor in Wisconsin. I'm not going to mention his name. And I told him about this. He said, Steve, I promise I will pay the bail and legal fees for anyone who gets arrested.
Hundreds gathered for a protest in Brookfield last Saturday. Thousands said on Facebook that they would attend today's rally. It's a big group at a time when crowds are officially banned, but a poll released by the Associated Press this week suggests they're still in the minority. Just 12% of Americans said stay-at-home restrictions go too far. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, as many of us shelter in place and work from home, we've stopped many of our normal movements, so much so that seismographs can tell the difference. We'll learn what that means for the study of seismic tremors. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, protesters were at the Wisconsin Capitol today to demonstrate against an extension of safer at home orders. According to some national polls, a majority of people support those measures staying in place, at least for a while. We'll learn more in just a bit. Now, in the midst of stay at home orders, people are moving around a lot less by car, bus, or train. Those movements make sounds, and seismologists, the scientists who listen to the Earth's natural sounds, can actually measure the difference. They're now getting a much clearer signal and less human background noise. Celeste Labeds is a graduate student in geophysics at the California Institute of Technology. She works in their seismological laboratory, where her current research examines subglacial conditions by using seismic tremor data. Celeste, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I wasn't aware how much seismometers can hear and measure. I thought, you know, earthquakes that we can detect. There's a lot going on even when the rest of us aren't paying attention. What is the kind of background noise going on in the earth?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. Most people just think of seismometers when they think of earthquakes, but those are really, really, really sensitive instruments. They can detect nanometer-sized movements. And those are happening all the time. So that's what we call the seismic background noise. You can get it from sources like the ocean is a major natural source of seismic noise. All of those waves moving around can create motions in the ground. You can even detect when you're far away from a coast. And humans can make some seismic noise, too. And that's what we're interested now in the age of COVID shutdowns. Things like transit and industry can all make small motions in the ground. And it's actually pretty intuitive. You know, if you've ever stood next to some train tracks when a train goes by, you can tell it's shaking the ground a little bit.
Yeah, I never would have thought of that, though. We humans are a source of this background noise. And this is something that's really measurable, right?
Yeah. You can detect, even under normal circumstances, no shutdowns needed, you can see a big difference in seismic noise levels between the daytime and the nighttime and weekdays versus weekends, just because of differences in human activities.
And I've seen reports from places like Italy where they have Messi quakes, where Lionel Messi, the soccer player, scores a goal and everybody in the stands jumps up and down at once.
Yeah, if you have seismometers anywhere near a place where people are going to gather, it'll certainly show those gatherings. At the University of Nebraska, where I did my undergrad, they once put a seismometer near the football stadium on Husker game day, and they have a printout of the recording of the course of the game.
Okay, so now here we are. Many of us are staying at home during this disease outbreak. What do the levels look like now?
So they're dropping in cities. They're dropping by a lot. So if you are looking at a seismometer that's out in the middle of nowhere, then you don't get much of a change because there's no human activity. It's just picking up natural sources. But somewhere like Los Angeles, where I live, it's a big, big difference because a lot of seismic noise comes from a lot of human activity. All of those cars on the road, all of those trains and planes, all of those industries and businesses, all kinds of things like that. Even just people walking around are making noise. So when places are making the smart decisions to, you know, move to work from home and avoid other people and just not be moving around as much, then yeah, we can see a big difference on those seismometers. A normal weekday now during lockdown looks a lot like a weekend during normal pre-COVID times.
We're talking to Celeste Labeds from the California Institute of Technology. We're talking about seismometers and how they can measure these human impacts in the Earth, the Earth's movement, and it's a lot less now as cities are being shut down, largely shut down because of COVID-19. Celeste, does this kind of human-created background noise make it harder for some geologists to do their work? Are we interfering with the signals you're trying to see?
So humans do show up on seismometers, but you don't have to feel bad about it or anything. Seismologists are used to working with human noise, and they know exactly how to figure out, you know, what is human noise versus what is natural noise that they might be looking for. But it is kind of cool that there hasn't been a period of sustained quiet like this for this long. And so one interesting application of this for scientists is that you can detect smaller earthquakes a little bit more easily if you have lower background noise. So we've always been able to detect these small earthquakes that no human could ever feel. We could always detect them, you know, maybe at night when noise levels are really low. But now, since noise levels are pretty low all the time, we can detect a few more than we could before, which is pretty neat. It'll be interesting to see how earthquake detections during this period of time would compare to a more normal level of human activity.
Did I see there was just an earthquake in the LA area just a few days ago? Am I right?
Yeah. Just last night, I believe, just after midnight.
Oh, just last night. Okay.
I guess not
time's,
this past
time's
night, but the night before.
Right now,
Earth Day, just after midnight.
Right, the Earth Day earthquake, people were saying.
Yeah, Earth Day earthquake. So that's the kind of earthquake that we can see no matter what human background noise levels are, because that was a pretty bigger one. That was a magnitude 3.7, I believe. So the kinds of really tiny earthquakes that are harder to see due to normal background noise are really low magnitudes. So magnitudes that no human would ever feel. You can get tiny magnitudes that are magnitude 1 or even lower, because it's a logarithmic scale. They can even go negative, and those are really hard to detect. So when these noise levels are lower, it's kind of like trying to hear your phone ring in a library versus trying to hear your phone ring in a rock concert. The difference between the noise you're looking for and the background noise is really, really different.
I've seen people raise the concern, lay people like me, I should say. If all our walking and driving and trains and whatnot is actually measurably shaking the earth around us, does that have an impact on, you know, fault lines? Is it going to wiggle an earthquake loose somehow?
Nope, it makes no difference at all, thank goodness. So if you live in an area with any earthquake hazard, you don't need to be any more or less worried than you normally do. You should still be prepared, as always. You know, earthquakes aren't going
to
take a break because we're busy with another disaster. But yeah, the processes of earthquakes happening and the processes of noise happening are at pretty different scales. So you don't really have to worry about this affecting earthquakes.
All right, weird question for you.
Bring it.
If we arranged for a whole bunch of people in the city to synchronize their clocks and at the same second just jump and all hit the ground at the same time, would that be seismically measurable?
It would probably depend on how close the people were to seismometers. Uh-huh. So something like just the weight of a person, one individual person isn't that much. And if you were nearby a seismometer, it could certainly detect it. But if you get much further away, then maybe not. So if, if you're in the same building as a seismometer, or if you're outside and see a seismometer station, you can go hop around and it would be detected there. Okay. But just everybody hopping in their homes probably wouldn't show up very much.
Okay. Well, I really wanted to sell that stupid question. Okay.
It's a fun question.
Yeah. So what are you watching for now on seismometers to see if our activity goes back up, if this change keeps going? What are you looking at when you look at these reports each week?
So what I have been looking at, just to see how humans are being affected, I'm looking at the background noise level. So I get the data from the seismometer, and it contains everything that the seismometer is picking up from any source. But if you do some clever math with it, then you can get rid of things like earthquakes in the data and just look at the background noise levels. And so from that, I can look at the amplitude of those and how they're changing over time. And so when I look at that, you can see a big difference from before the shutdown versus now. And the quietest day so far was Easter Sunday. And the whole week leading up to Easter Sunday was actually the quietest week that Los Angeles has had so far. And I hope we can keep it up. The week after, it got a little bit stronger again. But hopefully we can all stay home and I'll keep seeing those numbers stay low.
Amazing. Celeste, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Celeste Labeds is a graduate student in geophysics at the California Institute of Technology. She joined us for a look at stay-at-home orders and how they're making the Earth itself quieter in a way that actually shows up on seismographs. Coming up, we'll talk about public opinion and protest when it comes to safer-at-home orders. That's up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the world has seen viral outbreaks before. Why did it shut down over this particular one? A reporter takes us through some of the most recent outbreaks and tells us why this one is different. First, protesters came to the state capitol today to demonstrate against Governor Tony Evers' extension of safer-at-home orders that keep some non-essential businesses closed, many of them, and advise people to stay at home during the COVID-19 outbreak. This is the latest in a series of demonstrations in several states demanding an easing of social and economic restrictions. In general, public opinion polls show majority support for stay-at-home measures so far. According to an NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, nearly 60% of Americans are concerned the government will ease restrictions too early. Another poll from Politico in mid-April puts that percentage higher at 81%. Our next guest joins us to talk about public opinion when it comes to stay-at-home rules and how COVID-19 became political. Mike Wagner is a professor and Lewis A. Meyer Faculty Development Fellow in the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be here.
Mike, are you at all surprised that given our partisan divide in the country, that there's been a strong political element to our reaction to COVID-19?
Well, I think that given how polarized the country and the state are, it's not surprising that there's a bit of a partisan divide. But to me, I think the real story is that most Republicans agree with virtually all Democrats that people should be staying at home, that the state's response to the pandemic has been an appropriate one, and that these are the measures that the public, both Republican and Democratic majorities, strong majorities, think that the state should be undertaking.
Right. There's been unusual agreement, as you say, in polling. Why do you think that is?
Well, usually when there's a major national crisis, there is a rally effect that scholars often call rally round the flag. So people tend to prioritize a national or statewide identity. We often see that result in an increase in the approval rating for our leaders. We have seen that at the state level. Republican approval of Governor Evers has doubled from where it was from the previous Marquette Law School poll to the one that was released in early April, from about 20% to 39%. And we've seen not the same thing happen for President Trump. He's such a polarizing figure, and his messaging has been a little all over the place about the virus. And so he hasn't had the same bump that statewide leaders have had. But by and large, when there's a crisis, people tend to rally together, at least in the short term. And the question is how long that sustained unanimity will last. And, you know, things like the demonstration at the Capitol today is a sign that there's some fraying in that unanimity already taking place.
Yeah, let's talk about the protests, as you mentioned, today at the state capitol here. We've seen others often at state capitals around the country, some in other communities around the state. A lot of media coverage of them. How much weight do you put on these protests right now as, maybe a sign of potential growth in opposition to these policies?
I don't think it's a sign that there's a growth in opposition. A group of researchers that I was leading was in the field this week conducting a public opinion poll around the country, and we learned that over 95% of the people we surveyed said that they were engaged in some form of social distancing, and a vast majority of those, regardless of party, thought that they should continue to do so. And so I don't know that there's a big fraying. I would say in Wisconsin, the best data we have specific to our state is that about 13% of Republicans thought the government's reaction to the pandemic was an overreaction. And so I think we can confidently say a little more than 1 in 10 Republicans are being represented in some way or another by the views shared by some of the people at the demonstration today. One thing that the demonstration could do is start to signal to people who aren't sure what they think about the pandemic and social distancing guidelines, or who are just getting increasingly anxious about their own bottom line, businesses that are important to them. Folks like that might start to waver in their support of government distancing restrictions as there's more evidence reported that some people, namely those demonstrators today, don't agree with those restrictions.
Now, as with any demonstration organized by anyone, there are different people showing up with different messages. But a core message that I think organizers in particular are trying to stress is the economic impact of these shutdowns on workers who are laid off or furloughed, on small business owners who are shut down right now. And I think there's some concern for that across the political spectrum, whether it's blaming the shutdowns themselves or some people have worried about the federal government reaction, you know, helping larger businesses, but maybe not these little guys. Is there something there we should be paying attention to, the idea that there are people being hurt economically and that people in power aren't necessarily paying enough attention to that?
Absolutely. There's more than one thing happening at a time right now. The first and most important thing is the collective health of the country, and that's where the distancing guidelines are coming from. But of course, the economic issues are absolutely crucial as well. I mean, we're looking at what's being forecasted as pretty significant negative economic growth over the next bit of time. We could have over 20 to 25 million Americans unemployed by the official unemployment measure, which would just be an enormous increase over where we were a month ago. And so there are absolutely real economic concerns being felt by virtually everyone. And those who've been furloughed or laid off are especially feeling those. And they're doing so in this environment where they're being told the best thing to do for the collective health of the country is to stay at home. And they're wondering, quite sensibly, how do we pay for our lives? How do we keep our family fed? How do we keep people safe? And these two things aren't necessarily it's not obvious how those two concerns about health and economic security flow together. And that's where we're starting to see, I think, some frays in the unanimity of purpose that we saw more of in the initial response to the pandemic and the distancing guidelines.
We're talking about protest and public opinion during the current pandemic. Mike Wagner is with us, professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike, I know one of the things you pay attention to in normal times, we can throw quotes around normal if you want, is, you know, where different groups of people get their news and information from, whether that's different by where they live, by their partisan affiliation, that kind of thing. Are you watching to see what's happening with where we're getting our information about this disease from?
We are. One of the things we were looking at in the survey we just finished fielding today was where people get their information, but also what kind of environment do they live in? Do they live in a county that has zero newspapers, one newspaper, or more than one? And we're finding, you know, some evidence that even just living in a place where there's less information available, when we kind of combine that fact with who people talk to about politics and whether they listen to opinion talk radio, news talk radio, watch national news sources, all those things kind of move together to help us understand who supports social distancing, who supports the president's response to the pandemic, who trusts the CDC and the WHO for information about the pandemic. There are real partisan differences that I think are kind of flowing through where people get their information, and all of that is nested in the communities in which people live in the first place.
So what are you watching for as this goes on, Mike? I know we'll be watching for your survey results, for example, and others coming out. What kind of things are you watching for to see, you know, how people feel about these safer at home orders as they extend from 1 week into another?
One other thing we've been investigating in this research is, what do people believe about the COVID-19 virus? And is that are those beliefs accurate? So we asked a wide variety of knowledge questions about how you might get the virus, how many people in your own county have been affected, how many in your own county and state are dying, what do we know about the validity of a bunch of different rumors of treatments that are floating around the internet and other kinds of places. And so we're going to be looking to see who believes things that aren't true, and are the people who are believing things that aren't true the ones who say we need to open up right now, as compared to follow the health experts who are telling us we need to wait longer to make sure that the collective health of the country is something that we exit the pandemic with.
I want to bring on a caller real quick. Tom is on the line in Port Wing, or from Port Wing. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Rob. I just think your guest is a little bit out of touch with the reality. This is not a COVID issue, and it's not an issue of being well-informed or ill-informed. It's a matter of bread and butter. This is a bread and butter issue. It's work. It's the lifeblood of the individual and the individual family.
Tom, thanks for the call. So he's saying the protest there, it's not about COVID. It's about the way we make a living here.
Well, that's just what I was saying a few seconds ago. There are two huge tensions happening now. One, the public health risk that we're all facing with the pandemic, and two, the huge economic risk that we're all facing. And as I mentioned, those two things for a great many of us are in conflict. And that's, I think, why we're seeing some of the fraying of the support among some for the social distancing guidelines.
What do you make, Mike, of the communication we're seeing from government at the state and federal level in our last couple of minutes?
Well, I think at the state level, we're seeing a little bit of partisan discord, right? The Republicans in the state legislature want to have more of a say in what the social distancing rules and regulations are in the state. And so they're contesting Governor Evers' executive order to the Wisconsin Supreme Court so that they can have more of a say in that discussion. Governor Evers has been relatively steady on wanting to follow the science, but is also made changes, relatively rapidly and sometimes without informing key players about what those changes are going to be, which often happens in fluid situations. At the national level, the communication has been much more disparate. President Trump has said that the virus, isn't anything to worry about, would be gone by April. He's also said that it's terrible and very dangerous and that we should be staying at home. And then he also tweeted that we should be liberating various states, which many took to mean that people should do the kind of protesting that we saw today in Wisconsin. And so it's been a mixed bag that I think is sowing confusion amongst people about what their risk really is to the virus.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to Mike Wagner, professor and Lewis A. Meyer Faculty Development Fellow in the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. He joined us on the show today to talk about public support for stay-at-home orders, what public opinion polling is showing, and protests surrounding the measures, including one here in Wisconsin today, others at state capitals around the country. You can follow the Wisconsin Public Radio News team reporting on these issues, including today's demonstration at the Capitol. You can do that at WPR.org/news. And you can follow for quick and timely updates over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll post a lot of our news stories up there about the developments politically and research-wise when it comes to COVID-19. Sports mostly are not happening these days, so we're really making the most out of the sports news we can get, like the NFL draft, where the Packers made a move to get what they hope will be the quarterback of the future whenever the Aaron Rodgers era ends. That move alone is going to keep sports reporters and fans talking for weeks, possibly years. Some people are looking to the past of sports these days. For example, we had a conversation earlier this week with the author of a new kids book on some lesser-known stories in baseball history. Fun stuff. You can check out the archives at WPR.org. Over at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, J.R. Radcliffe has a fun series on the best 50 moments in Wisconsin sports history. He's about halfway through it now, I think, and I think we're going to invite him onto the show, and he's getting pretty close to number one on that list. Around the world, some sports are actually happening. In Taiwan, where they seem to have gotten the virus under control early on, their baseball league is playing games with a twist. There's no crowd there. Well, there's kind of a crowd, but it's made out of cardboard cutouts. The games are being played mainly for TV and live streaming audiences, but some stadium seats are taken up with cartoonish cardboard cutouts of cheering fans. Also, for some reason, there are robot drummers, which maybe should be at all sporting events. Looking to the future of sports, UW grad Jason Gay, sports columnist at the Wall Street Journal, is going to come back with us next week, Wednesday, for his thoughts, serious and comical, on what's to come in the sporting world. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.